Is Google serving consumers or threatening competition?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California and is supported by Ally Bank, offering Pop Money, a way to pay other people online by sending an email or text. Learn more at allybank.com.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Good morning. I'm Jeremy Hobson. If you're searching for Google's chairman, Eric Schmidt, today you can find him in the hot seat on Capitol Hill. He'll be testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee at a sensitive time for Google. The company, which controls 65% of the web search market here in the U.S., is being investigated for possible antitrust violations and uncompetitive practices. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
If you ask Jamie Quart at Consumer Watchdog how he'd like the ongoing federal investigation of Google to play out, he's pretty blunt.
It has to be broken up by the government. Google is bigger than Ma Bell. It's gotten too big.
That outcome is almost unimaginable. But at the very least, today's hearings are a distraction for Google executives. Federal investigators are concerned that Google is using its dominant position in search to direct traffic to its own sites, like Google Maps or Google Places. So if you Google hotels in Los Angeles and hit enter, what pops up is a page full of results from Google Places. You have to scroll down the entire screen before you see any results from competing sites like TripAdvisor. Herbert Hovenkamp is an antitrust expert at the University of Iowa, and he isn't convinced any of this violates antitrust law.
It's very, very easy, costless for customers to switch away from Google if Google is not serving them well.
There are lots of competing search engines out there, from scrappy startups like DuckDuckGo to established players like Yahoo. And the outcome of any government investigation is expected to take years. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, elsewhere on Capitol Hill today, lawmakers will be voting on a bill to fund the government after the current fiscal year ends on October 1st. And it turns out that Washington's polarized politics could again lead us to the brink of a government shutdown. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is here live to explain what is going on. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So what is the issue that might bring about a shutdown this time?
Well, this is an impasse over federal disaster relief. As you know, we've had a lot of disasters recently, from hurricanes to tornadoes. So the Senate, where Democrats are in control, has approved $7 billion to replenish the depleted Federal Emergency Management Agency's Disaster Relief Fund. But the Republican majority in the House wants only about half that amount.
But both sides have come out and said that they want to fund FEMA, right? So what's the problem?
Well, Democrats say that the Republican insistence on paying for disaster relief by cutting spending from an electric vehicle support program will hurt the economy. Here's Democratic Minority Whip Steny Hoyer.
You and I both agree it ought to be paid for. The question is, when do you pay for it? Do we pay for it right now? If you target this particular fund, you are targeting a fund which has demonstrably grown jobs.
But Republican Majority Leader Eric Cantor argues there's an even more pressing principle at stake.
What we're trying to do is finally face facts. We, in this body, in this town, must stop the federal government from continuing to spend money it doesn't have.
Well, it seems like, John, we've heard these arguments before, and things usually end up working out in the end when they reach this kind of impasse. Do you think a government shutdown could happen this time?
Well, you got to figure there's a way that Congress can compromise on this. It really just comes down to money. If anything, they have to salvage their poor approval ratings with the American people. But this is only the first of many financial quagmires that could force the government shutdown before next fall's elections.
Something to look forward to. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are mixed across Europe and Asia this morning, down just slightly in London right now. We'll hear from the Federal Reserve this afternoon and find out if the expectations are correct that the Fed will shift some of its investments in an attempt to bring interest rates down even further. On Wall Street yesterday, not a whole lot of action. The Dow climbed just 7 points to close at 11,408.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constant Contact, combining email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on the clock. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
Chicago's O'Hare International Airport is expanding to accommodate the 64 million passengers that fly through there each year. But turns out it's not just growing runways and control towers. As Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, O'Hare is now growing herbs and veggies.
Yep, it's right between Terminals 2 and 3 on Concourse G, a no-soil, vertical garden that grows everything from Swiss chard to green beans. Chicago's Aviation Commissioner Rosemarie Andolino became enamored with these aeroponic gardens after seeing one on an episode of Nightline. She asked airport concessionaire HMS Host to fund one at O'Hare. Now, some of O'Hare's restaurants are serving the garden's veggies to customers.
Passengers are demanding more nowadays. They want good quality food at their airports. They want choices, fresh choices.
O'Hare's veggies are growing inside 11-foot-high plastic towers. The roots are suspended in the air and fed a nutrient-rich water that trickles down through the towers and then gets recycled. Brad Mayer at HMS Host.
It's very functional. I was very surprised at the amount of crops that we actually harvest out of here. We get a full crop every 4 weeks.
Brad Mayer says O'Hare's new garden looks pretty, too. Maybe, O'Hare hopes, pretty enough to take your mind off that flight delay. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And finally, to a new museum that opened up over the weekend in Japan. It is celebrating the history of instant noodles. The museum was opened by the company that makes cup noodles, which is still run by the family of the inventor of instant noodles, a guy by the name of Momofuku Ando, who came up with the idea to solve hunger problems in Japan after World War II. He used to say, "Peace prevails when food suffices." Instant noodles definitely suffice. There are 95 billion servings being consumed around the world each year. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. And this is APM, American Public Media.
A thumb on the highway is an icon that's all but gone away.
By the time I was 15, I think hitchhikers had pretty much disappeared.
I'm Bob Moon. On the next installment of Freakonomics, where'd all the hitchhikers go? Next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.